Hi, and welcome back to the Beyond the Peloton podcast. I'm your host, Spencer Martin, and we are a week away from the Tour de France. It starts next Saturday, August 29th. I think that's the right date. Don't check me on that. But so there were national championships this weekend. It's always really hard to watch those. There's so many of them. They're not super well televised in the States, so I'm not going to review them, but we'll talk about a few of the winners. And then we'll kind of preview the first week of the tour just a little bit and talk about Ineos's new tour team that does not have Geraint Thomas or Chris Froome. As we saw at the Dauphiné, they just did not have what it took to be on that team. But before we get started, I do have a podcast or a newsletter called Beyond the Peloton newsletter, and you can sign up at beyondthepeloton.substack.com if you'd like to go a little bit more in depth with some visual aids and some deeper dives into race analysis, race previews, and a little bit of betting advice. And if you want to support the podcast, you can buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/BTPpod. So buymeacoffee.com/BTPpod. So let's talk about the big news this week. Was Team Ineos boss Dave Brailsford announced the Ineos team for the Tour de France, and it does not feature Geraint Thomas or Chris Froome, which is a pretty big deal for those guys. I mean, Geraint Thomas won the race in 2018, Chris Froome won his fourth tour in 2017, and Thomas was the runner-up in 2019 last year. So for them not to be at the race it's a big deal. The last time this has really happened was Bradley Wiggins won the tour in 2012 and then was not selected for the 2013 team because Team Sky team, because Chris Froome was the young up and coming rider for that team at the time. And he did not want Bradley Wiggins there. And Wiggins was signaling to the team he didn't want to do teamwork. So it's like poetic symmetry that Froome is now being left off a tour team in favor of a younger rider in Egan Bernal. And I've been pretty critical of Ineos's stated strategy of going to the tour with, they were saying they were going to go with Geraint Thomas, Chris Froome, and Egan Bernal they never said this. I guess it was just kind of implied and the media built it up that they were all going to be co-leaders. I thought that was a disaster and they just should consolidate around Bernal. So I actually really agree with this move. I mean, we saw that Froome and Thomas were just awful at the Dauphiné. We talked about it last week. They were finishing stages 20, 30 minutes behind the leaders on mountain stages, which is not where you need to be 2 weeks before the first mountain stage of the Tour de France in a race that's incredibly predictive of how the Tour normally goes. So, I mean, Brailsford is a really smart guy, incredibly ruthless. He made the right decision. He saw that they just weren't ready. And if with Froome, it makes sense. He had a life-threatening crash, 15 months ago? It makes total sense he's not ready to go. I'm not quite sure what's going on with Thomas. I mean, he knew the dates. He knew that the tour was at the end of August for quite a while. He should be ready to go. I think that, they're kind of spinning this positively and saying that, Geraint Thomas is going to go to the Giro to lead the team there, and Chris Froome's going to the Vuelta, and he's going to lead the team there. I think that's just positive spin, and I'm quite surprised how the Anglophone media is just like pick that up and accept that reasoning. That doesn't totally add up to me. I mean, Geraint Thomas is so bad that I'd be surprised if he could be ready by the Giro. I mean, a lot of these young riders, the level is so high, like they're so good, and the level's so high now that you just really got to come with your A game. He's not going to be able to just kind of like ride into shape the Giro and then find himself winning. And he's never been that type of rider to begin with. I mean, he's a big pursuer who's had to work incredibly hard to lose weight and be in shape, be in tip-top shape at these Grand Tours to compete in them. So I think he's going to have a really hard time. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if we never see him at a Tour de France again on Team Ineos because, Brailsford, the way he's built this team with Bernal, Andre Amador, Richard Carapaz, who they pulled from the Giro, as he was preparing to win the Giro or to compete for the overall win at the Giro this year, they pulled him out of that for the tour, which is kind of I was surprised by that. For them to switch strategies midstream like that is incredibly rare. They almost never do that. Mikhail Kwiatkowski, who's not what he used to be, but still strong domestique. Luke Rowe, who's very strong. Pavel Sivakov, who we know is really strong, and Dylan Van Barrel, who's one of the strongest domestiques out there. That's a pretty good team they've put together at the last second. You know, not a bad team to cobble together. And if Bernal can recover from this mystery back injury that they're saying he has, I mean, that should raise red flags. If he was really, truly hurt, if his back was bothering him that much to the Dauphiné, I can't imagine it's going to be better in a week. And then how much is that going to be bothering him 20 stages into the tour? But let's say he can recover from that. That's a pretty strong team to support him. And in the newsletter last week, I did say Carapaz, you know, had like a puncher's chance at the overall if things didn't go well for Bernal. After thinking about that for a few days, I'm not quite sure I agree with that assessment, because the tour tends to favor strong time trialists, even in editions where there's not a lot of time trialing. I know that doesn't make complete sense, but just the way the French climbs are, the French Alps, and even the Pyrenees to an extent, they really favor big, like not big, but relatively big rulers like Tom Dumoulin, Chris Froome, Geraint Thomas. I mean, just look at the last few winners. It's been Geraint Thomas, Chris Froome. An exception to that is Vincenzo Nibali, who is a small rider, actually kind of similar to Carapaz. So if you're going to push back on my point, that's who you would say. But, you know, Bradley Wiggins, Cadel Evans, Lance Armstrong, these are all strong time trialists who I think do well in the tour, whether there's lots of time trials or not. And Chris Froome's run would prove that. He's won the race when there's a lot of time trialing, and he's won the race when there's not a lot of time trialing, because he just kind of turns every mountain stage into a time trial where you're out there and it's just a watts per kilo contest. And these big guys can get skinny enough that they can just kind of go a terminal velocity on the climbs and keep the small climbers from attacking. But, you know, it's going to be a weird tour. I'm now talking myself back into Carapaz. But if you're going to say he's going to never win a tour, that would be your reasoning. That it's just not the type of race for that type of rider. He's not going to be in tip-top shape. If he was going for the Giro, I mean, we saw him get dropped at Lombardia last weekend. I'm actually surprised that hasn't been talked about. I haven't seen anyone mention that. They said, oh, we don't know his form. It's like, yeah, we kind of do know his form, because we saw him at Lombardia getting dropped 50K from the finish. So not a great sign, actually. And they're also spending this and saying, well, Froome is going to the Vuelta and he's going to lead the team there. I'm seeing like esteemed journalists, like Andrew Hood said this, who's a really longtime journalist in the sport, like, oh, there's still an outside chance Sky could, or Ineos could sweep the Grand Tours. It's like, what are you talking about? Like, Froome and Thomas are so bad right now. And what normally happens at the tour is, let's say Bernal doesn't win the race, he automatically gets sent to the Vuelta to lead. It's like the second chance for anyone who is close to but doesn't win the tour goes to the Vuelta. So, you know, Carapaz is probably going to do the Vuelta. Bernal's probably going to do the Vuelta, even if he wins the race. And so where does Froome fit in on that Vuelta team? I think Brailsford, he's a very smooth operator. I think it's really smart what he did, kind of spinning this as, well, you know, it's like a corporate, it's almost like a corporate demotion where it's like, well, we're giving them a chance to shine in other arenas that are just as important. Well, they're not nearly as important. I don't care if Bradley Wiggins says on his podcast that all Grand Tours are equally important and that Geraint Thomas, this is a blessing for him so he can focus on the Giro. Now, this is a huge, huge, huge demotion that, I mean, it's borderline unprecedented, and I don't even see how Froome is going to be the team leader at the Vuelta. I'm calling it now. I think a lot of these guys in the tour, I mean, what about Sivakov? You know, he's a young rider they're going to want to give a chance to. If he does a good job at the tour, they're going to have to reward him by giving him leadership at some point. If Sivakov or Carapaz or Bernal goes for the Vuelta, that leaves Froome high and dry. So keep an eye on that for later in the year. So coming back to the tour, I do like their team that they cobbled together. I don't think they're the strongest team in the race by any means, but Dave has given them a chance, and that's, you know, kudos to him. He's a good, really good team manager, and it's impressive how he's kind of like pulled a rabbit out of a hat here with, you know, they were careening towards disaster, and he's righted the ship and given them a chance to win. So, and they're going to have to do it in a different way. I don't think they're strong enough to do their Ineos train that they tried to do at the Dauphiné and it blew up on stage two. They're going to have to be really shrewd. It's going to make the racing better for us. It's better for the viewers. They're going to have to get really creative and kind of ambush teams like Jumbo Visma in the mountains and on transitional stages. So it's good for us. It's bad, I guess, for Froome fans and Thomas fans. Actually, I think Thomas is kind of an interesting guy. I don't mind him, but you got to be disappointed with how he just, it's almost like a lack of professionalism. Like, how could this happen? How could you not be in better shape? But maybe he's a rider who, I guess we've never really, this is an unprecedented situation, and maybe he needs a lot of racing to get in tip-top shape, and it was just never going to work out for him. So let's talk about Jumbo-Visma for a second. The Cycling News podcast with, I know I called out Daniel Benson last week, and I'm going to call him out again this week. It was, they did this podcast where it was basically like, why Roglic can't win the Tour and Egan Bernal can. And they were saying, they're just like moving the parameters of the argument to fit whatever they want it to fit at any point in time. They were saying, well, Bernal, the team just pulled him out of the Dauphiné because they knew to avoid him getting his teeth kicked in later in the race. So it's like, well, if he was going to get his teeth kicked in, he's not good enough to win the Tour. That doesn't really make a lot of sense. And if it's like, A, if he's not in good enough shape, then he's not going to be good enough shape at the Tour. If his back was hurt, and that's why he was going to get his butt kicked, it's still going to be a problem at the Tour, probably. I tend to think that, I don't think that's totally, I wouldn't totally write him off. I think, maybe there was some inter-team drama there. I would imagine that was a pretty tough situation for him at the Dauphiné. I haven't heard many people talk about this. It's just kind of a crackpot theory of mine that he must have been really, really pissed at Froome and Thomas, just kind of like dragging last. They were like coming in with the sprinters every day, and that must have been pretty demoralizing. And then thinking, God, I got to go to the Tour with these guys, and this, they could cost me my second Tour de France win. I wonder if there was some backroom maneuvering there, and then that was the catalyst for the last second change of team. If he's really hurt, that's going to be tough for him. But they were also saying that, so Roglic has a history of, let's go through the argument against Roglic. Some of them are valid, some of them are not. So let's say he peaks early and he falls apart in the third week of a Grand Tour. Well, that's happened once. That happened last year at the Giro d'Italia. And he was peaking in like February, like way too early, months before the Giro. So being strong 2 weeks before the Tour is different than being strong 4 months before the Giro d'Italia. Oh, and also, so he crashed at that Giro d'Italia. He crashed, I believe it was like at the end of week two on Lake Como, similar roads to where Remco crashed last week. Very tough roads. He crashed. His team manager was taking a pee, so he didn't get a new bike, lost a lot of time, and his team was incredibly weak. It was like, I don't want to rag on Jumbo. They're like the strongest team in the world this year, and they're like a well-oiled machine, but they were not at their top, on the top of their game at the Giro last year. That's pretty unprofessional to be taking it, just, peeing a bottle, man, in the car. What are you doing? But it was like a very important point of the race, and they're just not there with a bike for him. So that really cost him. His team was weak. That crash probably affected him in the third week. So I would kind of like almost throw out all that data. Like, he had a bad final time trial, and their Cycling News is saying, well, he can't time trial in the third week because of that. And he traditionally has, had slightly disappointing time trials in the last few days of Grand Tours. But let's remember, this is pretty shocking when you look at this. He has only done, let's say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Grand Tours total ever in his career. So I think he's still on an upward trajectory. So let's also remember, the last Grand Tour to occur in the sport, he won the 2009 Vuelta, and he was strong in that third week, really strong. There was a stage they went over, it was like a gravel section. It was like a really tricky gravel section. There was like a monsoon. He crashed, and then he rode the final climb faster than anyone else because he had to make up time. So if you use that as like a time trial, like effort, I believe that was like stage 18 or 19. So, if we splice out the last 50 minutes of that stage, obviously like the physiology is there to go hard for that amount of time in the third week of a Grand Tour. So at his first Grand Tour ever, 2016 Giro d'Italia, he wins a stage. Second Grand Tour ever, 2017 Tour, wins a stage. 2018 Tour, wins a stage in his fourth overall. That's his third Grand Tour ever. And he's done 5 Grand Tours. He's won a stage, and he's never not won a stage in a Grand Tour. I don't think any other active rider has that same record. So 2019 Giro. So this is, he's after his third Grand Tour ever, first Tour de France, he gets second Tour de France, he gets fourth overall. 2019 Giro, wins 2 stages, gets third overall. Pretty freaking impressive. 2019 Vuelta a España, wins a stage and wins the race. And that's the last Grand Tour to occur. So if you're just looking at that, it's a pretty solid Palmares. I mean, that's better than Egan Bernal. You know, he's done two Tour de France's. One, he was working for the team. Last year he won. You know, that's good, obviously, but he didn't look, you know, he didn't look unstoppable. He wasn't a machine. You know, he kind of held in there. He had a bad TT, and then he just chipped away time in the third week and won the overall, which, you know, speaks well to his, you know, his composure to ride well when he's not on his best physically. But it's not like he's some machine. It's that his flaws get pointed out less and his missteps get pointed out less than they do Primoz Roglic. I tend to think it's like a little bit of anti-Eastern European bias. You see this a lot in professional cycling, and especially coming from the Anglophone media, where they amplify the flaws of Eastern Europeans or Central Asian riders, and they'll just kind of brush over that for Western Europeans or people who speak a lot of English and maybe they want to get interviews from, or they think might read the piece or listen to the podcast. So I think that was like, it was completely slanted. You know, I'm not going to sit here and say Primoz Roglic is unstoppable. That crash in the Dauphiné that could be a problem. And I saw there was a Dutch magazine or a Dutch newspaper where he gave an interview this week where he said he thought he'd be feeling better right now. That's not the most confidence inspiring message I want to hear at the moment. If I'm betting on him to win, so that's kind of worrisome. But I mean, I think it's completely hypocritical to bash his record when he's never gone to a Grand Tour and not won a stage, going up against Egan Bernal, who I think has much bigger weaknesses than him and is on a weaker team. And he's only ridden two Grand Tours in his life. He won one. He's a 50% win rate. That's incredible. I'm talking myself into Bernal the more I talk about this, but I just think he had a lot of missteps, and that Tour de France win last year that he got away with because I think the field was a little soft. People don't talk about that a ton, but he had, you know, an out of shape Geraint Thomas got second, Steven Kruijswijk got third. You know, that's not like, oh, I would say like a world class Tour de France field. So I just, let's be mindful when we're saying, oh, when we're making arguments about like Roglic can't win because he has this history of falling apart. It's like, well, that happened one time and he crashed and he had a terrible team and his team really screwed him over by going to the bathroom at the wrong time. So just be mindful when approaching this. And if we look at the current betting odds for the overall picture, to me, they've kind of balanced. They're coming into balance a bit. It was a little goofy with Thomas and Froome were both like in the top five, even after their terrible Dauphiné performances. So now that we've gotten them out of there, it actually makes it a little bit harder to bet. You have Roglic at plus 175, which is, you know, the betting markets have a lot of confidence in him. Those are expensive odds. I'd really want to be sure he's going to win before I put that, you know, before I bet at that. I think I put money on him at plus 550, which I love. You know, I loved him at that price. This is a little pricey. Egan Bernal, plus 275. Tom Dumoulin at plus 700. In my newsletter last week, I said the Tour would be won by one of those three, and they are currently the three top favorites, according to the betting markets. I think that's exactly right. And keep an eye, I mean, Dumoulin looked really strong at the end of that Dauphiné. You know, I think he's not being talked about, but he is, you know, he could easily win this thing. He's a great time trialist. He's great in this type of race. He's won a Grand Tour before, and he's got to be loving this under the radar. You know, there's like no pressure on him whatsoever. Thibaut Pinot at plus 700. That's expensive for Pinot, my lord. Pogacar at plus 1400, that's a little pricey for him. Carapaz at plus 1400, that's really pricey for him considering he hasn't been training for this event. Emmanuel Buchmann at plus 2000. I'm surprised he's even racing at a bad crash at the Dauphiné. So, yeah, that's really expensive. Julian Alaphilippe at plus 3300. So, that actually reminds me, let's talk about, I got a question from Kevin in Basel. And if any listeners ever want to send me questions, just email me at beyondthepelotonpod@gmail.com and I'll answer them on the podcast. But Kevin had an interesting point where in France and Spain the past couple of days, the COVID cases have been surging. Like France had 16,000 new cases on Friday, which is a lot. That's more per capita than currently happening in the U.S. And there, you know, there's talk of closing the borders. So, but that also impacts the national championships happening this weekend, because if riders, I think, are all staying, who won the tour are staying in France for fear of leaving the country and not being able to come back in before the race. So if that, if all of this is happening, and there was like a day where I think there was like 17,000 new cases in Spain, which is right across the Pyrenees from France, all of this is making me a little nervous that the tour is going to get cut short. If these cases continue to surge, and there's been a few riders this week that have had COVID positives, it's all speculation, but it appears to be spreading through the peloton. And it's like, who knows if that's happening in race or just, you know, in the mixed zones around the race. You know, you could easily imagine coronavirus spreading from, you know, teammates to, you know, media members. They're distancing kind of, but there's a lot of contacts, especially with like race personnel and the riders. Like a race doctor, if he treats one rider for road rash that has COVID, he gets it. He treats other riders. I mean, they're all going to get it. So I'm a little nervous. I hadn't really seriously considered this. I'm nervous that it could get cut short midway. And the UCI has a rule on this. It's incredibly vague. It's really vague. And if we remember, even the Tour de France last year was cut short. Like the last two important stages 19 and 20, had like severe weather, and they were cut short. And so that rule applied, you know, allowed the race to like still be legitimized, even though it didn't run in its entirety. It's unclear to me what happens if like it gets called off 14 stages in. I think they could, it's, you know, the rule is so broad that they can interpret that as who is ever leading at that point wins the race. But so Kevin's question was, does the possibility that this thing goes a week and a half, does that increase Pino and Alaphilippe's chances of overall victory? And it does, like exponentially. So I hadn't really considered this, but you know, if let's assume, we have to assume a few things here, that like BetMGM or whoever your bookie is would respect your bet if the race didn't finish. I think if ASO and the UCI count it as a Tour de France victory, the bookie would. I think they'd have a hard time pushing back on you. So, you know, there's a bit of room for like gamesmanship here, where Alaphilippe's at plus 3,300. This first week is like set up perfectly for him. I think he's going to be in yellow after stage two. And so if he's in yellow going into, I don't know, the second week and the race gets called off, he could win the thing. And ASO, the organizer of the tour, really wants a French winner. So if either Pino or Alaphilippe is winning and it gets cut short, you can bet that they're really going to push for that thing to count. So I would normally, you know, I've talked about how I think Alaphilippe support bet and not to bet on him. This makes it a little bit more interesting. You know, at plus 3,300, you could put a few bucks on him and hope that the race gets called off. It's kind of that's like the darkest timeline, but it's getting more and more likely that could happen. You know, the counter argument to that is ASO is just going to push through no matter what. You know, there could be 30,000 cases in France a day, and they're just going to push this thing to the end. They're gonna finish it. It also gets dicey where they came out with like a rule this week where if two team members or anyone affiliated with the team test positive, that the whole team gets pulled. So all of these bets, you know, you could bet on Roglic. He's winning. Two teammates test positive and he's out of the race. You know, that would suck. That's possible. So it really puts a cloud over all of this. And normally I would say just kind of balance your bets on Roglic, Bernal, Dumoulin. One of the three is going to win. You know, if you do it right, you're going to win no matter who wins, no matter which of those three win. But that kind of complicates it. And you might want to look at some of these riders further down, like Alaphilippe, that could have the yellow jersey, and then you have an incident where the race is called off. Before we go further, I do want to mention that Steven Kruiswijk on Jumbo-Visma he dislocated his shoulder at the Critérium du Dauphiné, and he will not be riding for Jumbo-Visma. I kind of suspected that. You know, those are really hard injuries to come back from. It seemed like he wasn't going to make it. But what's the weird part about this is they're replacing him with, I've never heard of this rider. He's a Norwegian rider. His name is Odmund Jansson. but he doesn't, he's not the same type of rider as Krozwick at all. Krozwick was going to be like the perfect ace to play in the mountains. He's going to be a great mountain domestique. This guy's 83 kilos, which is like, that's like what I weigh, or maybe even a little bit more. But so he's going to be, I assume, Norwegian at 83 kilos. The guy is just like probably, you know, can put out the watts like all day. He can probably sit on the front. He's going to be great on the flats. But that's a little bit of a strategic change for them to go from to replace a mountain domestique with like a big ruler for the flats, crosswinds. You know, I kind of like it actually, because Krozwick, I love him. He was going to be really valuable in the mountains. I think it gets a little messy if you have Dumoulin, Krozwick, and Roglic. It's like three guys who maybe think they could all win the tour. It gets a little dicey when you get to the pointy end and, you know, decisions have to be made on the road. Assuming Roglic is healthy and Dumoulin is healthy, this is not the worst thing ever. You get a big asset for the flat stages, these crosswind stages. A lot of stuff goes down at the tour, and it can really help to have a big, strong rider to get you through that. I think that helps. I actually like that. I don't know if that's, I don't know what their logic was in that pick, but maybe they think, hey, George Bennett and Sepp Kuss are riding so strong at the moment that they're going to be there in the mountains when things get really hard. They also have Robert Hessink, who is a great climber as well. Wout van Aert, who he can hang until like the last climb if you ask him to. If he's really dedicated to doing teamwork, the guy is so versatile. He could be there until the last climb. So I actually, a lot of people were framing this as a negative for them. I kind of think it's a positive. And this all assumes Roglic is healthy and ready to go. But even if he's not healthy, I mean, Sepp Kuss could step up and maybe fill that secondary leadership role. And if we look at that first week of the tour, so it starts with, you know, normally these things start with like boring sprint stages, and it's just like boring. It's like a TT, maybe a prologue on the first day, like a time trial. And then it's like seven stages of just like, oh my Lord, this is boring. And it's a sprint every day. They're going away from that, which is great, but it makes it really tricky. I mean, this first stage in Nice, it's a circuit race in Nice. These roads are like really like, if you're not in the water, if you're not standing in the ocean in Nice, it's just like all uphill inland. So it's really tricky roads, really windy, really undulating. I think it's going to be like a reduced sprint, but you could have a GC contender lose time here if they're not paying attention. There's going to be splits. They're going to have to be at the front. It's actually great for a rider like Alaphilippe. And then stage two is like, they're classifying it as a medium mountain stage, and it has a 5.5 kilometer climb, and it crests 9 kilometers before the finish, but it's all downhill and Nice to finish. I mean, we saw this at the Vuelta a España last year, where it was a similar stage on stage two, and some riders lost like 10 minutes, like Theo Gegenhardt and Wout Poels on Team Ineos were both like boom out of the GC because they just got caught out on a stage really similar to this. So it's something to keep an eye on. I think Alaphilippe's going to thrive. This is perfect for him. I bet he's been thinking about this for a while, and I bet he's got yellow coming on stage two. And then we get into a little bit more of just a normal routine for the tour. We have like stage three is flat, stage four is hilly, stage five is flat, stage six is hilly, stage seven is flat, stage eight, nine are Pyrenean mountain stages, rest day on stage, it would be stage 10, but we don't count that as a stage. Stage 10 is flat. 11's flat, 12 is hilly, 13 medium mountain, 14 flat, 15 Grand Colombier, big mountain stage. So it could get interesting here. Just if we're just assuming the race gets cut off 2 weeks in, if it gets cut off before that Grand Colombier stage, Alaphilippe could easily win this. I mean, if that was just a 2 week stage race, that's perfect for him. I mean, it is. If Roglic is holding that form, it would also be perfect for him. So it gets, you wouldn't bet on Bernal though. If we just assume this thing isn't going 3 weeks, Bernal's not a good pick at all. As you're noticing, as I'm going through that, there's not many traditional flat stages. So if we just look at the current odds for the green jersey, the points jersey, Peter Sagan wins this thing pretty much. I think he's won it every year he's finished the race, which is incredible. A record, I think he has 7 wins. So yeah, so he's at a negative 182. So to win, you'd have to bet $182 to win $100. I almost think it's worth it. Sam Bennett's second at plus 500. Wout van Aert's third at plus 600. Wout could challenge him, but Wout's doing teamwork. You know, he's occupied elsewhere. He's not going to be competing for this thing. Caleb Ewan's not going to win it at plus 900. Viviani, he got dropped the Italian national champs this year. Not going to win it at plus 1600. Then it's like Sonny Cabrelli, Matteo Trentin, Luca Meskic. None of these guys are going to win it. If Sagan finishes this race, he's going to win this jersey. He could potentially crash out, but it's his. It's all his. This tour is actually perfect for him. He's been maybe a little undercooked in some of these races, but that could actually mean he's peaking perfectly for this race, for the tour. And I think I'm doing a piece that's going to run Wednesday on Velo News about his absurd consistency in the Tour de France. He's I think if you count mass start stages, he has the highest rate of podium finishes out of anyone ever in the history of the race, which is incredible. It's one out of three, 33% of the time he's on the podium. So he's a really good bet for that. And I think he's not been winning a ton of stages. He's been winning the green jersey easily without winning a lot of stages. I think this might be the year that he starts winning stages again. And so let's just go through a couple national championship notes, or just point out a few notable national champions. This gets a little tricky. So it was weird this year where they're doing the national championships the week before the tour. That's actually kind of normal. But with this fear of restriction of movement because of coronavirus, I don't think any significant contender or stage contender left the country. It would just be too risky. So the French national championships was won by Demar, and he's on FDJ, Groupama FDJ. He's not even going to the tour. So it's like a lot of these national champions are riders that aren't going to the Tour de France. So it's a real funky year. But so one just notable one I wanted to point out was Matthew Vanderpoel soloed for 44 kilometers to win the Dutch national championships by a minute and a half. That's really impressive. I pointed out in the newsletter last week, I've kind of been ragging on him for being out of just not having the form he had in 2019, but he held on. I mean, he was 10th at Lombardia, which doesn't suit him at all. I mean, that's such an impressive result to get 10th at a race that is not up your alley in the least bit. So that signaled to me that his form is maybe coming around a little bit, and he might be one to watch in the spring classics. I think they're in October this year. Very weird. It's hard to get used to that timing. But just note that. Keep an eye on that when those races come around, like Tour Flanders, Paris-Roubaix, that he seems to have that form back. That was an incredible win. And then Spanish national championships. I mean, just if you look at the top two, it's Luis Leon Sanchez and Gorka Izaguirre. I mean, Sanchez has got to be like in his late 30s. It shows like the lack of, like they've almost like missed a generation in that country. Like Sanchez was winning Spanish national championships when I was first getting into cycling. Kasper Asgreen won the Danish national championships. He's a really strong rider. He's also one to watch out for when those spring classics roll around. And Pascal Ackermann got beat actually at the German road race championships, which was surprising to me. They're hard to watch. There's so many of them. I mean, maybe if there was like a channel that would like collate on them, they can be interesting because you see riders like Mark Cavendish would actually have to race. He wouldn't have a team that would pull him around just to sprint to the end. So actually, there was like racecraft involved. It would all be these Team Sky riders just dominating the British champs, but then racing against each other. So you can't see interesting racing. It's just hard. It's often not worth the effort. You can find highlights later. So I don't pay a ton of attention to the national championships. But they you know, normally they signal form coming into the tour, but with this cluttered schedule, there's not a ton to glean about the Tour de France from those. That is all we have this week. We're going to do another midweek Beyond the Peloton podcast, just another Tour prep where we're going to like dig into who to really watch out for in this first week, dig into some of these stages that I think are going to be important, kind of analyze the first and second stage. I think those are going to be key. And I think some big riders might lose some time on those. Check out the newsletter at beyondthepeloton.substack.com. I started a premium. You get a daily newsletter every Grand Tour stage for this year, and then you get two additional newsletters on top of the free weekly one after that. So check that out if you're interested at beyondthepeloton.substack.com, and thanks for joining us.